What now after Chairfulness McCormick quits? Did Amazon break a jobs deal with Miami-Dade County? And how do we keep Rip Currents from claiming victims here? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss the resignation and replacement of Democratic Florida Congresswoman Sheila Chairfulness McCormick amid corruption allegations. We'll examine whether Amazon is violating a jobs agreement with Miami-Dade County when it closes a Homestead shipping center this summer. We'll look at more heartbreaking Rip Current deaths here and how to prevent more. And along the way, we'll remember the life and music of Michael Tilson Thomas. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. South Florida U.S. Representative Sheila Chairfulness McCormick resigned this week. It was sudden, but hardly unexpected. Chairfulness McCormick was the first Haitian-American Democrat ever elected to Congress when she won a special election in 2022 to replace the iconic Alcee Hastings in Florida's 20th District, representing parts of Palm Beach and Broward counties. But she spent much of her three terms battling congressional ethics allegations and a federal indictment on corruption charges. Chairfulness McCormick, who goes on trial next year, denies those accusations, but two big questions stand out. How did it come to this? And when will the 20th district seat she just vacated be filled again? When will Florida Governor Ron DeSantis call the special election that's mandated by the U.S. Constitution? So far, he's being mum about it, and this isn't the first time. Which of the six Democratic candidates now scrambling to replace her, including former rap star Luther Campbell, is a primary favorite? We, of course, would like to know your thoughts about the Chairfulness McCormick crisis. Are you a constituent of the 20th District? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Haley Fuchs, a congressional reporter for Politico who's been following the Chairfulness McCormick drama in Washington, D.C., and WLRN Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie. Haley Fuchs, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us what Congresswoman Chairfulness McCormick was staring at this week inside the House Ethics Committee that prompted her to resign her seat.
Mm-hmm. So the former congresswoman was accused of illicitly funneling millions of dollars to support her congressional campaign. The House Ethics Committee, which is the body that adjudicates allegations of misconduct against lawmakers, had already found by clear and convincing evidence that she had committed dozens of infractions.
Yeah.
This week, we were going to hear whether or not they were going to recommend expulsion or some other punishment. But it was common knowledge on Capitol Hill that the committee seemed pretty likely to recommend expulsion, which is the most serious punishment that they can recommend, and that's full removal from the House.
Yeah, and she was staring at like 25 different counts, you know, among those allegations.
Yes, 25 out of the 27 that were brought against her.
Right, and that money that you're talking about, those millions, it's about $5 million, that stems from COVID relief money back during the pandemic that sort of fell into the lap of her family's healthcare business, which she should have returned but instead kept. Is that an accurate summary?
Yeah, it was an accounting error by the part of the government that ended up with $5 million influx into her campaign.
Right. Now, Congresswoman Chairfulness McCormick called the Ethics Committee investigation an unfair witch hunt, saying, quote, "I simply cannot stand by and allow my due process rights to be trampled on and my good name to be tarnished." But Ethics Chair Michael Guest, a Republican from Mississippi, insisted, quote, "This was not a rush to judgment." Now, either way, Haley, you reported that the Congressional Black Caucus chair said it's best now for Chairfulness McCormick to focus on her well-being. At the same time, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said she did the right thing for her constituents. Not a real robust defense that you're feeling there from the party. Is there a feeling among Democrats up there that the Congresswoman's case had become sort of a party millstone?
I think the important context for this is that Democrats have been very vocal in calling out ethical issues in the Trump administration.
Yeah.
So there's certainly kind of pressure on them to hold their own accountable and to that same standard.
Yeah, good
It really
point.
seemed that Democrats were on the precipice, or at least a critical mass of them, of supporting the expulsion effort. The House needed a two-thirds vote for her to be expelled. That would require significant Democratic support, but the sense was that she was going to be expelled should the committee have recommended that.
Now, there was also a point that her lawyers made when, when she was calling this an unfair process, that if they were to go ahead with this expulsion, it would unfairly compromise her legal trial or, her criminal trial next year. What do you think brought her ultimately to the point where she just said, "Okay, I'm leaving"?
So to what I said earlier, it really seemed that she was on the precipice of being expelled. It kind of was, she was reaching the end of her road. This case had gone on for years, and it had really dragged on. And certainly, if she had been expelled, that would have been a complicating factor for her criminal trial next year.
Yeah, right. Carlton Gillespie, Congresswoman Chairfallis McCormick is facing a federal trial next year, as I just said, on those charges that she, her family's healthcare business, and her campaign stole those millions we were just talking about of federal COVID relief dollars. She has pleaded not guilty, but reacquaint us with some of the more troubling allegations in that indictment, including the famous diamond ring.
Yeah, well, like you and Haley mentioned earlier, there was the $5 million that was misappropriated by the state. Now, she's claimed that she didn't know about this deposit or that there was this accounting error, but on the day it was sent to their account, she screenshotted the deposit to her brother, according to the indictment, and they let it sit in the account for about a month before they really started making a ton of money moves. They deposited into PACs for her to donate to her own personal consulting firm. And yes, I think the most scandalous is $109,000 to a jeweler in New York for a 3.14 carat, and let me make sure I get this right here, a fancy vivid yellow diamond ring. And of course, if you look at her official congressional portrait, unless she had a duplicate of the same ring from before, it looks like she's wearing that exact same ring in her
In
congressional
the port
portrait.
again, file that under the category of what were you thinking? In that sense. Now, Carlton, the Congresswoman's staff recently told the Miami Herald that she actually plans to run in November to recapture her 20th district congressional seat. It sounds like a long shot, considering voters up there are aware that even if she does win a new term, there's a very real chance she could be convicted and it would be cut short, meaning the term. Is she kidding herself here, or is there precedent for her to hold on to, perhaps?
We are kind of playing by Airbud rules, right? There's no rule that says a dog can't play basketball. And there's no rule that says because she's resigned in the face of these scandals that she can't run again. She certainly can, but there's not a ton of precedent for this. Henry Clay did this a number of times in the early 1800s. Since then, obviously not very common. And it does seem like the community is kind of the winds have shifted on her. She's had comments turned off on her social media posts for the last couple of months, so it's hard to tell how people are really feeling. But it definitely seems like it would be a long shot and a very tough sell for her. But she is making that sell. She is saying she's being persecuted. She says the fight is not over. She thinks she's being, kind of scuppered in this. Her name is being slandered unfairly. So it seems like a long shot, but it's a pitch that she's making.
And Haley Fuchs, in this regard, up there on Capitol Hill, is there a sense that, again, going back to the Black Congressional Caucus and people like Hakeem Jeffries, is there a sense that people like that are telling her, don't do this, don't think, don't complicate things? Is there a sense that they are trying to tell her behind the scenes not to run again?
What I heard unanimously was she did the right thing in resigning, and I think certainly she's going to have some trouble getting building support on Capitol Hill should she actually pursue this bid to try again.
Yeah, okay. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Haley Fuchs of Politico and WLRN's Carlton Gillespie about this week's resignation of Florida Congresswoman Sheila Chairfallis McCormick amid corruption allegations and what happens now to replace her. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Haley Fuchs, Chevalis McCormick was the only Haitian American in Congress. Last week, we saw the House, with 10 Republicans in support, to the surprise of many, pass a bill to extend temporary protected status, or TPS, for Haitians, which would keep the Trump administration from ending that protection and deporting more than 350,000 Haitians back to the crisis in Haiti. That was obviously good news for the Haitian community, which has been a big target of President Trump's anti-immigration campaign. And some would say rather cruel slander when you consider the accusations, the false accusations he made back in 2024 about Haitian migrants eating people's pets in Ohio, which is sort of a monstrous accusation. But is there a sense there, Haley, that losing the one Haitian American voice on Capitol Hill leaves that community more vulnerable?
Mm-hmm. I think, to your point, there is some bipartisan support for the interests of the Haitian community, but certainly we're operating in an administration that has been very aggressive in targeting that community.
Yeah.
And so, we're due for another shakeup in the House later this year. And, maybe there could be an election of another Haitian American to the House. But certainly it's a tough time given kind of the administration's immigration agenda.
Yeah, but still, to that point, is part of the reason the Democratic Party bosses up there don't exactly seem to be in despair over Congresswoman Chevalis McCormick's exit is that they know her district is one of the few in Florida that's pretty much a lock for Democrats?
I mean, I think they're a little worried now, given the fact that losing her vote, and the lack of plan with her choosing her successor, what that could mean in the short term. And additionally, a redistrict in Florida could also kind of throw things amok.
That's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. And I'm also glad you brought up the point that, yes, we are staring at a hiatus here where they will not have, her vote on the Democratic side of the aisle. When we're looking at what's going to be happening between now and the next Congress coming in January, how concerned are they about that, having lost that vote?
I mean, Republicans are pursuing another reconciliation bill, a big policy bill. We also have FISA, the spy bill. We have a number of big pieces of legislation that are moving through Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrow majority that we have of House Republicans means that any single vote can lead to big, significant things in the House.
No, that's a great point. So, Carlton Gillespie, let's look at what's unfolding now in terms of who could replace Chevalis McCormick. The U.S. Constitution, as I pointed out, says Florida Governor Ron DeSantis must now call a special election for that purpose. But so far, he doesn't seem to be moving on that mandate. We're only about 6 months away from the November midterm election. So what do things look like then in terms of getting a special election held in the 20th district between now and then?
It certainly comes at difficult timing. And this isn't a new issue for DeSantis. Alcee Hastings, who held represented this area since 1993, he died in office in 2021. It was 9 months before the special election happened in this district.
Right.
And DeSantis has multiple times dragged his feet on calling special elections, not just for Democrats, but there was also concerns with the two seats that were vacated, Matt Gaetz and Mike Waltz, when they were nominated by the Trump. He waited, I think it was something like almost 2 months to call those special elections. So this is something he has been sued about this before. The ACLU has stepped in and said he needs to do this in a more timely manner. But again, there's no real hard limit that he seems to be bound to.
Why does he move in sort of this deliberate speed, would you say?
I don't know. And he's been criticized a whole bunch. I mean, I think there is the desire to jump to making it a political thing is that, he doesn't want to do it because it's a Democratic district.
Uh-huh.
But again, he has dragged his feet in Republican races on this. This is just something he's dragged his feet on both sides of the aisle.
Right.
So the thing that makes this complicated is, like you mentioned, elections take time. You have to give people time to do mail-in ballots and register and candidates to declare for a special election. And by the time it rolls around, it could overlap with this midterm and cause even more confusion just for someone to be in a seat for 2 or 3 months that if they don't win that August primary and November general in the midterms, they may be out of the seat.
No, great point. And remind us then, Carlton, who are the six candidates who have already thrown their hats in the Democratic primary ring to replace Chair Phyllis McCormick? I mentioned former rap star Luther Campbell, but there are other front runners, including two whom Congresswoman Chair Phyllis McCormick had sued for accusing her of the things she's now been indicted for, right?
Yeah. Elijah Manley, who's very young, has been in this race the longest. For a while, it was just him. But of course, as soon as the federal indictment dropped, this race got a lot more competitive. A lot more people threw their hats into the ring. So Manley's been in there the longest. He has the most money. And in February, he was leading if you take Sherfless McCormick out of the polls. So, but that's before Luther Campbell got in. That's before a couple of the other folks got in. So
And Dale Holness, whom she defeated in that special election in 2022, is also in, right?
Holness is in. He was in that poll against Manley, but Holness lost to Sherfless McCormick by just 5 votes in that 2021 special election. He's definitely seen as a front runner, a longtime county commissioner. You know, you've got Maysha Williams, who is actually Alcee Hastings' stepdaughter, worked for both Hastings and Sherfless McCormick. Mark Douglas, who was a commissioner in Sunrise for a number of years, ran for mayor in 2024 and lost. And like you mentioned, Luther Campbell and Dale Holness. And also Rudy Moyes has declared that he's going to run. He ran for Frederica Wilson's seat in Miami 10 plus years ago. He's now moving up to see if he can get this seat in the 20th district. So that's just on the Democratic side.
Interesting race. Haley Fuchs, I just want to end things here by turning to another facet of this story that you reported on this week, the House Ethics Committee itself and the changes it's making to, let's say, find more of a backbone. Chair Phyllis McCormick wasn't the only member of Congress to resign in recent days because of ethics issues. So is this part of a new trend that we're seeing up there?
I think there's incredible scrutiny recently on members of Congress and their alleged misconduct. Obviously, to your point, recently saw the resignations of Tony Gonzalez and Eric Swalwell, who were accused of sexual misconduct. You know, the public pressure these days has effectively forced out 3 members of Congress in, you know, less than 2 weeks. The Ethics Committee, I spoke to a number of members of the Ethics Committee, and they're admitting their shortcomings as in this kind of push for better congressional ethical oversight. And we could see changes, you know, coming up to the process that in which the House adjudicates misconduct.
So along those lines, could another Florida congressman, U.S. Representative Corey Mills of the 7th District, who himself is under House ethics investigation for financial and also sexual misconduct, could he possibly be next?
I think people are starting to look now to Corey Mills and what's going to happen there. The case against him is very complicated and very multifaceted. He maintains his innocence, but it's likely that the next case the Ethics Committee really pursues is the Corey Mills case.
Okay. Haley Fuchs is a congressional reporter in Washington for Politico. Carlton Gillespie is WLRN's Broward County reporter. Many thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks.
Still to come, is Amazon violating a jobs agreement with Miami-Dade County, or is it just moving the jobs around? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. 2 years ago, shipping giant Amazon, owned by billionaire Miami son Jeff Bezos, built a $43 million warehouse in Homestead. It employed about 1,000 people. But this week, Amazon announced it's shutting the facility down in July for 2 years in order to retrofit it to become what it calls a full-scale fulfillment center. The company insists it's not laying off the Homestead employees, but offering them the opportunity to relocate to open jobs at other Amazon facilities in Miami-Dade County and South Florida. But Miami-Dade County officials really aren't buying that explanation, and here's why that matters. In exchange for acquiring the property, Amazon signed an agreement to create at least 325 jobs at the Homestead site, paying at least $32,000 a year for 17 years. The county can fine Amazon if it violates that deal and place a lien on the property. And this week, Miami-Dade commissioners like Danielle Cohen-Higgins, who represents Homestead, did vote to sanction Amazon for breaking its word with the warehouse closure. Joining me now to help us better understand why the Miami-Dade Commission is taking that action, I'm joined here in the studio by Commissioner Danielle Cohen-Iggins. Commissioner, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Tim.
And we'd like to hear our listeners' thoughts about this dispute and the private-public agreement at issue. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Commissioner, take us back to the agreement Miami-Dade County and Amazon struck before this Homestead warehouse facility went online. Walk us through the deal that was made in terms of what Amazon got and what the county got in return.
Absolutely. This is land that was previously owned by the Air Force, and it was acquired by Miami-Dade County at no cost to the county.
Out by the Homestead Air Force Base.
Very close to the Homestead Air Reserve Base. Mm-hmm. We refer to it as HARB very frequently in the South, so that that geographically orients your listeners to the area that we're discussing. This is land that was conveyed to the county with the specific written intended purpose of economic development. So there were certain restrictions on what the county could do with this land. And in 2020, when Amazon approached the county to acquire the land, a deal was struck at that time because Amazon represented to the county that we are going to bring jobs to the South, something that everybody can and should get behind. And so a deal was struck. They acquired the land for approximately $22 million, but they acquired—
Now tell us, in context, was that a good deal for them?
It was fair market value, which is important to note. It wasn't as though Amazon came in and kind of took the land at a very, very low premium. It was at market value at that time. So in fairness to Amazon, it was an acquisition that was an arm's length transaction where the county got fair market value. However, in order to acquire county land, typically you need to compete for it, right? It is not a transaction typically where you, Tim, or I would go to the county and say, hey, I want to buy your land. Land is very, very precious. It's the most valuable commodity that we have in the South, second, of course, to our residents. So typically, land would transfer, particularly government land, through a competitive process. This was a no-bid process, right? So Amazon didn't have to compete. And that's important to note because when you are going to do business with Miami-Dade County and you are receiving a financial benefit, which Amazon received significantly, right?
By not having to compete.
By not having to compete.
So that allowed the county then to throw in, you know, certain points of negotiation that were very, very, you know.
Exactly. And it's important to note this didn't happen 10, 15, 20 years ago, right? This was just a few years ago back in 2020. So all, you know, the ink is still drying on this. And we're saying, hey, you know, the whole purpose of this land by declaration of restrictions is for economic benefit to the South. And that's important because there's a lot of development happening in the South. And our residents are saying time and time again, we're always having to commute to the North, which is creating additional congestion. We need to create opportunity centers in the South, which will alleviate traffic and increase quality of life.
So I see that on old Cutler Road
all the time.
I live in Palmetto Bay and I
see it. I'm on old Cutler Road every day for hours on end. So any opportunity that we have to reverse traffic patterns by creating employment centers in the South, obviously, all things considered being equal, we should champion those. And that's how this was presented to us.
So this is why Miami-Dade County then made these conditions that they would have to maintain 325 jobs at that site.
Correct.
Paying $32,000 a year and maintain those jobs for 17 years.
Correct. Okay. Black and white ink.
So why then did you and fellow Miami-Dade County commissioners vote this week to take action against Amazon for shutting down its Homestead warehouse facility based on that agreement between Amazon and the county? What was at the heart of the complaint you, for example, issued that prompted the vote?
Yeah, so I sponsored the legislation because after I did some research on this and spoke with our county attorneys, everybody agreed that this is a violation of the agreement. And frankly, Amazon announced this closure in a way that I consider to be a cavalier way. And I say that because you have a recorded declaration of restrictions associated with that 2020 transaction. If you want to amend or change the declaration of restrictions, there's a process that you can go through, i.e. apply to the Board of County Commissioners and seek a formal amendment of those declarations of restrictions, i.e. we're not going to be able to maintain 325,000 jobs. In fact, they just did that a couple of years ago. They needed an extension on the agreement. So they know how to do this. They didn't do that here.
Okay.
They didn't come to us with a formal application. Instead, they put out a statement and articles to the press saying, hey, we are going to have to relocate or remove 1,000 jobs. Now, 1,000 jobs, maybe in the center core of Miami-Dade County, may not seem like a lot, but in the South, in Homestead, 1,000 jobs at one location is a big deal for a lot of families.
And I want to get to that. But first, I just want to ask you to quickly tell us, what are the fines and other penalties that the county will now seek to levy against Amazon, and how will these sanctions be enforced?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. Within that contract, there is a liquidated damages provision, and it's been reported on that that number can be pretty high. Some would argue that for Amazon, that's just a drop in the bucket. My angle is a bit different. I would prefer not to go the route of liquidated damages. Mm-hmm. I would prefer for them to honor their contractual obligation and keep the 325 hardworking residents of South Dade on payroll and find them
but
work in the South.
But wouldn't that require some sort of legal action to get them to stop the plans to close down this facility?
Yes, or they work it out. They're Amazon. There are other centers. There are other locations, right? When you're talking about a behemoth company the size of Amazon, I find it incredibly difficult that they can't find accommodations for 325 employees. And this translates to families, food on the table in the South, which is the area that I'm proud to represent.
But let me here read a statement we received from Amazon spokesperson Amber Plunkett regarding the issue of job layoffs, which Amazon seems to insist are not layoffs, but rather job relocations. Ms. Plunkett told us, quote, more than 300 employees from our facility in Homestead have already accepted transfers to stay with Amazon at other facilities, most of which are based in Miami-Dade County, and our HR team continues to work with our employees to transfer them to other locations that best fit their preferences. She goes on to say, we have 8 operation facilities in Miami and 30 across South Florida. For those who prefer not to transfer, we're providing transition support. When this facility reopens in mid to late 2028, it will employ approximately 1,000 people, and employees will have the option to return at that time. End quote.
Sure.
So again, Commissioner, Amazon says what you're calling job eliminations or a failure to maintain that minimum of 325 jobs at the Homestead site are in fact job relocations or transfers to a host of other Amazon facilities in the county and South Florida. What is your and the county commission's response to that?
Yeah, so we appreciate the statement, and obviously jobs that don't need to be eliminated and can be relocated. If the families are in agreement with that, then great, move forward with those families. But the lion's share of those relocations are from Homestead to Opa-locka. Mm-hmm. And if you're a resident of Miami-Dade County, you know that that is a substantial change, okay? And so when this news broke on March 6th of 2026, our office started receiving phone calls like, I'm about to lose my job. We're uncertain as to what is happening here. And in conversations that I've had with Amazon, there has not been a firm landing place on them saying that we agree and we're going to comply with this agreement.
Do you feel that Amazon is taking into account, for example, the fact that a worker may have bought a condo, let's say, down in Homestead for the express purpose of taking this job at this Homestead site, now being told, well, you've got to work in Hialeah if you want to keep this job.
Hialeah, Opa-locka, yeah.
And so commuting back to Hialeah from Homestead is
correct.
Not exactly
what we're doing
a lifestyle
is we're now adding to the already expansive travel route of most Miami-Dade residents, i.e. from the south to the north, which is exactly what we tried to reverse by creating economic opportunities in the south. And again, I appreciate the efforts of Amazon. We're certainly not trying to be difficult here, but the fact is, if you are unable to honor contractual obligations that were just entered into only a few years ago, why should I have confidence that you are going to bring back even more jobs or 1,000 jobs into the future? Like I've said before, the best way for us to predict the future is to look to the past. We look to Amazon to honor its contractual obligations, not only to us at Miami-Dade County, but to the amazing residents of South Dade.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami-Dade County Commissioner Danielle Cohen-Higgins about Amazon's decision to shut down a warehouse facility in Homestead and whether that violates a jobs agreement the shipping giant made with the county. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Commissioner, I want to read another statement we received from Amazon regarding the company's business decision to close down Homestead facility for a 2-year renovation. Quote, we're always evaluating our network to make sure it fits our business needs and to improve the experience of our employees, customers, partners, and drivers. As part of that effort, we occasionally convert existing facilities to a new type of facility, which is what we plan to do later this year. They go on to point out that once, you know, these renovations are done, this fulfillment center that will be there in its place will create long-term benefits for our customers, employees, and the community for many years to come. End quote. Okay, so they're saying, look, we can't ignore our bottom line here, but is this perhaps a case where, and I think you alluded to this earlier, where the county is saying, well, Amazon should have thought of that possible future need to convert the Homestead facility before it signed a deal to keep at least 325 of the jobs there intact for 17 years.
Absolutely. And again, I think it's important to remember they're talking about renovating a space that was just constructed and completed with certificate of occupancy issued less than 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about a small warehouse. We're talking about a warehouse in excess of 1 million square feet. And think of the investment that Amazon literally just made. The paint is still drying on this building. Why are you renovating, right, 24 months after you just opened a brand new facility? It raises questions for me. It doesn't make sense logically. I'm not challenging what the statement says. Mm-hmm. I'm simply saying everything is brand new. You had 1,000 employees working there. Like you said, families may have relocated, but more importantly, you entered into contracts to gain significant financial benefit from government-owned land. The very least you can do is honor your contractual obligations.
But again, what about this argument Amazon is making that, okay, for 2 years, we're taking those 1,000 or so jobs at the Homestead facility away, but we're only temporarily reassigning these workers elsewhere. And then when we're done retrofitting Homestead, we'll have a spanking new fulfillment center for them to come back to work at in 2028, back in Homestead. But you seem to think Amazon is playing sort of three-card Monty here.
Well, you know, again, I don't have any reason to question the intentions of Amazon, except for the fact that that statement that you just read is just that. It's mm-hmm. a statement to the media. It has no contractual binding authority over themselves nor mm-hmm. over Miami-Dade County. And when you look at the contractual binding authority that they do actually have, they're not complying with it.
Yeah.
So I'm simply saying, you know, again, I've said Jeff Bezos is a son of our community. So much has been given to him from growing up in Miami-Dade County. This should be a very small issue. The statement that they should release should be one that says we are going to honor the contractual obligations to Miami-Dade mm-hmm. County as good economic partners, and we are going to maintain at a minimum 325 full-time employees at that facility.
Let me read one last brief statement then that we received from Amazon regarding the dispute between the company and the county. Quote, our team is working closely with Miami-Dade County and its attorneys, and we're hopeful we can find a cooperative path forward. Do you feel, Commissioner, from the county's perspective, that Amazon is working closely with you to find a cooperative path forward? And if so, what will that path look like?
Sure. I am always cautiously optimistic. I don't want us to have to enter into litigation on this. That would be an option of last resort. But again, it's curious to me. Amazon did this very recently. They certainly know how to do this. Why aren't they coming to us with a formal request to amend the filed and recorded declarations of restrictions on this property? Mm-hmm. It's almost like they're not interested in entering into a binding contract that says we're going to retrofit, we're going to renovate, and we're going to bring back even more jobs in 2028. They could have that route, and that would give us greater assurances. But right now, mm-hmm. there's nothing binding them to the statement that they are making in the media.
And just in the 30 seconds we have left, how could this case, do you think, affect in the future these kinds of private public agreements? Could this have an effect on how local governments and private sector do this kind of thing?
Yeah,
in the future?
I appreciate you asking that question, and that really is the macro perspective question. From my standpoint as a commissioner, I think it's very important that we as a county send the message to our private partners doing business with our community. We welcome you. We want whatever benefit you can bring to our community and to our residents. But if you're going to sign contracts with us, we fully expect that you're going to honor those agreements. Promises made must be promises kept.
Danielle Cohen-Higgins is Miami-Dade County Commissioner for District 8. Commissioner Cohen-Higgins, many thanks.
Thank you, Tim.
Before we go to a break here, we want to take a moment to remember legendary classical music conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, whom we lost this week. Tilson Thomas co-founded the New World Symphony on Miami Beach in 1987. It's an institution celebrated for his spirited style on the podium and his dedication to music education. WLRN's Christine DiMattei and violinist Gustavo Gus Correa, one of the New World Symphony's original members, remember Tilson Thomas here.
This is the piece that Gus auditioned with in 1987, Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 4. Within a few weeks, Gus got a letter in the mail telling him that he got in. The prospect of being conducted by Tilson Thomas was an opportunity too good to pass up, although he did have to deal with some jitters at first.
I remember that, you know, he was one of the gods. It was just like, oh man, I'm sitting in an orchestra and like, he's gonna get downbeat and here we go.
In many ways, Gus's career since then is a perfect example of what Tilson Thomas set out to do with the creation of the New World Symphony. In an interview with WLRN in 2019, he told us about his original vision for the conservatory program.
It was an amazing adventure because I had had a dream for a very long time of there being a place where young musicians could do some of their most creative work and really work that focused on their becoming who they needed to be, as opposed necessarily to fulfilling the expectations of some curriculum or another. Very crucial time in their young lives. Get out of conservatory or college and say, now what?
Gus remembers Tilson Thomas's way of getting the symphony members, called fellows, to that next step. And it involved a lot more than intensive study of music technique.
Michael would read poetry to us. He would mention paintings, you know, like a lot of context about what we were playing. And boy, I loved that.
That was WLRN's Christine DiMattei and South Florida violinist Gustavo Gus Correa. Michael Tilson Thomas died on Wednesday in San Francisco. He was 81. Still to come, how to prevent more Rip Current deaths like last week's heartbreaking tragedy in Cocoa Beach. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. On Florida's coast, we are sadly accustomed to news of people dying after they've been caught in the strong ocean rip currents that develop off our beaches. And yet, the tragedy that occurred at Cocoa Beach east of Orlando last week felt especially heartbreaking. A 42-year-old Connecticut man, after saving his 12-year-old son from being carried out to sea by a rip current, himself drowned in it, as did another man who'd helped him save the boy. It was yet another reminder that there's no such thing as too much public education about rip currents, what they are, how to recognize and avoid them, and how to escape one if you're caught in it. Lesson one, for example, don't try to swim against the rip current straight back toward the beach. Swim away from it, parallel with the beach. That's not always easy to remember, of course, when panic takes over. Which is why we're glad to have with us now Alex Bagwell. She's the Ocean Rescue Chief in Fort Lauderdale, and she has many years' worth of experience and wisdom to impart about rip currents and how to respond to them. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me here today.
We'd like to hear your thoughts. Have you, like me, ever been caught in a rip current? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Alex, today, in fact, the National Weather Service is telling us that the South Florida Atlantic coast has a high risk of dangerous rip currents, and we've had them for much of the week, actually. Remind us what causes these rip currents that flow out from the beach, what they are, and what makes one dangerous. I mean, we've had a lot of wind, for example. Does that play into it?
Yes. So here in South Florida, we tend to see strong rip currents if there is an east wind. And the longer the east wind blows, the stronger the rip currents are going to pull. So we've had east wind pretty much all week. Our rip currents are fairly defined and they are pulling today.
And when we talk about what makes a rip current, my understanding, and we had an expert on this a couple years ago on the show, my understanding is that these are channels that develop between sandbars. And when factors, as you just pointed out, wind, like the east wind, come in, it can create these currents that come in strong but go out even stronger, and that's what people get caught in?
Yes, that's correct. So here on Fort Lauderdale Beach, we don't have a pier or anything like that that would create a rip current, but we do have sandbars. And in between the sandbars, we have breaks and channels that are deeper areas. So the water tends to flow in the path of least resistance through those channels out. So the rip current does pull you away from shore. It doesn't pull you under. The under usually happens if someone panics, but they'll pull you away from shore.
Out to sea, right? Now, in the
Yes.
absence of flags out there, for example, alerting them to rip current danger, how can beachgoers on their own detect a rip current out in the water that they're going to swim in? Or is that even possible for the average beachgoer to do?
It is possible. So the rip currents tend to be a different color than the other areas where there's a sandbar. You'll see some water or some sand churned up and a little bit of choppy water. If there's seaweed, the seaweed also tends to hang out in the channel because it's deeper. So those are ways to identify rip current. Another thing that helps a lot is polarized sunglasses help you see the identify the rip current better.
Oh, that's a very interesting tip. Thanks. As an ocean rescue chief, Alex, what stands out to you though about the rip current tragedy that occurred last week in Cocoa Beach? And I'll just mention that one of the things that stood out for me was that the teenage daughter of the Connecticut man who died saving his son, she also tried to help her father, but the rip current almost took her too, even though she's apparently a trained lifeguard.
Yes. So with rip currents, if someone is in trouble, we always recommend getting help from a lifeguard first if it's in a lifeguarded area. And if it is not in a guarded area, we tell everyone to call 911. And while they are waiting for the 911 response, they can grab something that floats and try to throw it to the victim. We don't recommend entering the water without a flotation device.
What though stood out to you, if I, and I'm not really sure how closely you've looked at what happened in Cocoa Beach last week, but what stood out to you though in terms of the strength of that rip current, given, you know, the awful results that happened?
So we have had strong east winds for quite a while now. So those rip currents are really pulling. Cocoa Beach does get big surf, and the surf does create more water flow and faster rip currents. So they were definitely dealing with challenging conditions.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned some of these tips just a second ago, but I just want to ask you to walk us through then what we need to do when we start getting carried out to sea by a rip current. And just as important, what should people like that Connecticut father in Cocoa Beach, what should they do or keep in mind when they venture out to try to rescue someone if, let's say, if there isn't a lifeguard on duty there to that they can call out to? How do they avoid themselves becoming victims?
Like I said, if there's not a lifeguard, the first course of action would be to call 911. That gets additional resources coming to help everyone who's in trouble. If there's anything that floats, like a boat cushion, life jacket, anything like that, I would recommend bringing that out, so that the victims can stay afloat. Like I said, we don't recommend entering the water without a flotation device. If you're personally stuck in a rip current, relax. Rip currents don't pull you under, they pull you out.
Out, right.
Yep. Don't swim against the current. What that does is it really just tires you out.
Now, when we
And
say
then
don't swim against the current, meaning don't try to swim directly or straight back into the beach, right?
correct. Yeah, don't swim directly back to the beach. What you want to do is swim parallel to shore, and get out of the rip current. And once you're out of the rip current, you would want to make your way towards shore.
And again, one of the big things, and you alluded to earlier, don't panic. How often does panic play a role in tragic results in situations like these?
I mean, the rip currents make people panic very quickly. We do a good job on trying to educate people on where to swim and where not to swim, safer areas to swim, so the panic doesn't set in. That's in lifeguarded areas. People just need to remember if they can float or tread water, they should do that until help can arrive. And sometimes others may not know that the person's in trouble. They can just be facing the shore and not moving anywhere, or they're floating out to sea and they might think that they're just swimming. So they should yell or wave for assistance to alert people on the shoreline that they are in trouble.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Alex Bagwell, the chief of Ocean Rescue in Fort Lauderdale, about recent rip current tragedies along our Florida coast and how to prevent future ones. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Alex, you have 20 years of experience as a lifeguard and an ocean rescue expert. Can you tell us about a specific instance that stands out to you in the past of when you saved someone from a rip current there in Fort Lauderdale, for example, and what lessons the rest of us could take from encounters like that?
A few years ago, I was opening up my lifeguard tower to get ready for the day, and I saw two kids swimming by themselves about 50 yards from the shoreline. I couldn't find parents anywhere. So I called in that I was making a rescue. I brought the two kids in safely. A good Samaritan also helped because we were just opening up for the day. So my recommendation would just be make sure you're swimming in a lifeguarded area while the lifeguards are on duty. That was at 9:45 in the morning. I was just going on duty. If it had been 10 minutes earlier, it might not have had the same outcome, same positive outcome.
Is there any more risk to being caught up in a rip current if you're farther out from the beach, or does it not matter? You could get caught up in a rip current just as easily, 10 yards from the beach.
So the rip currents pull different lengths everywhere. Ours usually pulled to our vessel exclusion buoys, which are roughly 150 yards out, and any portion of that rip current will pull you out to the full extent.
Yeah.
They do have feeders from the inside that pull from the sides as well. And then the sandbars, like we discussed, do take a break, and that's where the rip current forms. So sometimes people are comfortable on the sandbar. The sandbar may be knee deep in calm water, and then 2 inches to their left or right, it is 10 feet of water and there is a rip current there and it's pulling out to sea. Yeah. So I would just tell everyone, if they're going to the beach, swim in a guarded area and also check in with the lifeguards to find the safest place to swim for the day, because we're sitting there staring at the water all day. We know where the sandbars are. We know where the rip currents are, and we can find the best place for you to swim to enjoy the beach.
Now, a couple of years ago, we had a rip current expert, Dr. Stephen Leatherman of Florida International University, on this program, and he pointed out there are different kinds of rip currents, but that South Florida's are the most hazardous because they're so-called clear water rips that are harder for swimmers to detect. Are the rip currents that you and other ocean rescuers here in South Florida confront more dangerous than on other coastlines, do you think? And how do you train differently for saving people from them if that's the case?
So there are various different types of rip currents. Like I stated, we don't have a pier here. We do have a jetty, but it's in our unguarded area. Places like that do form fixed rip currents, where if there is a rip current, it's going to pull off of that fixed structure. So those are easy to identify because next to a pier, you can see that you don't really want to swim there anywhere. There are pilings with, shells on them, and there's a strong current in that area. Same as rocks, you're not necessarily going to want to hop in the water right next to a jetty. So ours are more difficult to see. It's not based off of a fixed structure, but we are trained professionals, and we are able to identify them.
Now, either way, 7 Florida beaches, including stretches in Fort Lauderdale where you're based, are rated among the 10 deadliest in the world, and experts say rip currents are one of, if not the main reason for that. What more do you feel then we as a community need to do to raise better public awareness of rip currents?
I think we can continue to do interviews like this, and when we do have the rip current conditions, the strong east wind, make sure we are getting in contact with news channels and making sure the tourists and the locals know that we do have not ideal conditions for ocean swimming. I know Easter weekend we had a lot of rip currents and there was a lot of media, and people did say that they didn't go to the beach, or maybe that they stayed in close because they heard that there were strong rip currents.
Mm-hmm. All right. All great advice. Thank you. Alex Bagwell is chief of ocean rescue in Fort Lauderdale. Alex, many thanks. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Finally on the roundup, Miami's own Fernando Mendoza is going to the NFL with the Las Vegas Raiders. The Heisman Trophy winner led Indiana University to its first national championship earlier this year by, you'll recall, defeating his hometown's University of Miami Hurricanes. So not surprisingly, he was the NFL draft's first overall pick last night. Mendoza didn't attend the draft in Pittsburgh and instead watched it at his Miami home with friends and family, including his mother Elsa, who has multiple sclerosis. Mendoza, in fact, recently donated $500,000 to the University of Miami Health System to fund research and support for patients with that condition. The Raiders will count on Mendoza to turn the organization around after not winning a playoff game since the 2002 season, when it went to the Super Bowl. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.